This episode of Branching Out is brought to you by Oak and Iron. Garden-to-glass cocktails using the freshest ingredients. Open 5 days a week at 2967 East Thousand Oaks Boulevard.
Welcome to Branching Out, a podcast presented by the reporters and editors of the Acorn newspapers, offering you a closer look at the news in your community.
All right, welcome to Amateur Hour with Kyle and Ian. It is Monday, November 23rd. No, I'm just teasing. Kyle and I were very intimidated by the stellar performance given by managing editor John Losing and political analyst James Vazajan last week.
I don't think we should be having those guys on too much, or that our listeners might chase us out.
They're going to elbow us out. Yeah.
Exactly.
It is the week of Thanksgiving, and obviously cases are on the rise, which sucks, so nobody's really getting together with the family. But before we get into anything, we promised you a guest this week. That is not happening. Kyle.
Yeah, unfortunately, Cynthia Herrera from Ventura County Community College District had to call and cancel because she's had an exposure to COVID. She's not tested positive, but was apparently exposed to someone who has since tested positive. So to play it safe, credit to Cynthia. She rescheduled, so hopefully we'll have her on very soon, but yeah, we had to hold her off. But that just speaks to the times we're dealing with right now, where it feels like the virus is back in a big way. And with the holidays right around the corner, it really couldn't happen at a worse time. Are you going to know? Are you going to be seeing any family for Thanksgiving? I know you have some family in the area.
No plans.
Keeping it low-key.
Yeah, it won't be the first holiday I've spent by myself. It's whatever.
You're going to have something to eat now, some stuffing.
Yeah, I'm not going to be like in the dark just crying. It's a Thursday. It's a normal day.
Yeah. Yeah, same for me. My wife Jenny and I will probably, my daughter Kylie, stepdaughter Kylie, will be making dinner for us, and we'll just be a single household Thanksgiving, which is not really that strange for us, so I can't say like we're making this huge sacrifice.
Wait. Is she volunteering to make dinner, or is this some child labor stuff?
No, she enjoys doing it.
Okay.
Yeah, so I just have to eat and watch football. But I know for a lot of our staff that are, you know, have a lot of family around there, this is a time to sacrifice and a difficult time. I'm hearing a lot about plans being canceled left and right. So that is difficult. But again, I'm glad to hear so many people seem willing to make that sacrifice considering the situation.
So on today's episode, we're going to be taking you behind the scenes on two stories that we've published, one of which we've discussed on this show before, and that is the September 29th collision that claimed the lives of Mark and Jacob Iskander in Westlake Village. The other is a piece Kyle published this week, excellent story, about a family dealing with a couple of years' worth of stalking from an individual who turned out to be a neighbor. Let's start with that one, because honestly, I'm way more interested in that. It was a really well-written piece.
Thank you.
You kind of, especially, like, I'm relatively new to this field. I've been doing it about 3 years or so, not counting college. The way that you told the story was very, it had a much stronger narrative flow than the standard news piece, which I think really helped it stand out. But you decided not to reveal the name of this person. Take us through the process.
Yeah, so, I mean, to anyone who's read our paper for a long time or is familiar with journalism knows this is a very unique story in the fact that I didn't have an arrest to go off of.
Yeah.
So often the crime stories that we tell, Ian, you write them all the time.
Yeah.
We get a press release. We hear from the police.
So-and-so was arrested this day.
Exactly.
They'll appear in court this day.
It's
here's the charges.
Formulaic and we basically, the information comes through the department. In this case, I had a chance to speak with this family, the Kesslers. They live in the Three Springs neighborhood of Westlake Village. And they were able to share with me all this evidence they themselves had collected about what happened to them. So it wasn't just like hearsay. Here's actually and in this case, the gentleman that was stalking them was leaving these really creepy notes. Mm-hmm. The family's got three daughters, and this started way back in 2015 when the girls were – obviously 5 years younger, 15, 17, and 19. And then it stopped for a time period, and then it began again when the pandemic started.
Yeah.
Which I'll get to kind of why that is in my second part.
Okay, so I want to ask then, because there's no police record, there's no actual complaint filed, anything like that. Well, they did go to the cops.
Yeah.
Okay. But because there's no record, anything like that, like, because I've done one or two stories like this, it's kind of a gray area of like, well, do we just take this family's complaint and make it public, or do we And obviously, in this case, the stakes were a little higher. They were being stalked. They had evidence. But did you wrestle at all with...
Of course, great question. No, that's a really good question. I mean, this is a story that I've had for several months. I'll just say that. And because the circumstances were so unusual, I really had to, you're right, you had to really think about it. But like you did mention, they did go to the police. And as far as I know, the investigation into this matter is still open. So as far as we know, there could eventually be charges. But it sounds like this was more a situation where the police presented the case to the district attorney's office. Might sound familiar to you. And in my instance, they decided at least not at this point to file any charges.
Right.
So at that point, I could say, forget the story. There's been no crime. Why should we write about it? But then I'd be discounting everything as a reporter that was presented to me as physical evidence, which we don't ever usually have. You know, usually the police have the evidence. We just hear about it. In this case, I had video, photo, physical evidence that, and really why I have that is, to be real clear, what the family does have is a restraining order, a permanent restraining order against this person that was filed in Los Angeles County Court. So those documents are public. You know, now we don't usually get our hands on those. And a lot of times what I'll hear is, you know, well, you've never done a story on someone who had a restraining order before. And I'll say, well, obviously a lot of times restraining orders are very much personal, domestic, a boyfriend, girlfriend, husband and wife. This is two different families.
Right. They don't even know each other.
Exactly. Yeah. There's no familiarity there. So I felt the circumstances were a little bit different, but it was not, again, like you said, it was not an easy decision. And it's one I spent a lot of time thinking with and talking to the family and really weighing it. And since then I've also talked to the family of the gentleman involved, and I weighed all that into a decision to say, you know, the public deserves to know about this.
Yeah. I want to ask about why you wrote it the way you did with that more narrative storytelling line and the fact that you didn't do just a straight news lead of here's who's accused of doing this, here's what they did.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was because it was so non-traditional even how I gathered the story and the information that was available, and because the they had given me such information, but it wasn't the kind of crime you could explain in a few sentences.
Right.
I spent a lot of time, even when I did talk to people about it, with John, with other people at the paper, it wasn't so easy to get out in a few sentences.
Well, stalking is kind of a nebulous term.
Yeah.
So, I mean, laying it out the way you did.
So I think I decided as I started to write it that I had an opportunity to make it more about the family and really their courage and their willingness, because really they made my job easy because they gathered everything up.
Yeah.
And they were able to lay it out, dates, times, when it happened.
Right.
And I felt like this was going to be, and it was, I'll admit, it was very interesting. I knew it could be presented in a way chronologically that would work because that's how they experienced it.
Right.
They didn't know what was going on. And so I'm able to put the reader in the place of that they were at where this is all happening to them, but they don't know who it is.
Right. Well, and I think the story did a good job of doing that in that, like, I, as the reader, kind of got to experience what the family got to. And even it was interesting, like, even because you put in copies of the notes that this person left for the family, even reading those in the story, I was just hearing them in like a weird kind of creepy voice that was just like, the language alone is unsettling. But
the notes are what make this story, you know, so interesting. And you have to lay them out for people. And people can, I guess, I'm hoping the readers will decide for themselves, was this a criminal act or not?
Yeah.
And once they see part two, they'll have the full picture. But this is the kind of story that I think goes on, and we never hear about it. Even here in Westlake Village or in one of the communities that we cover, a lot of time this could happen and we may never find out about it. And credit the family for being willing to – they went on the record with me.
Yeah.
They put their names out there. So there's a certain amount. There's always that danger. We see in the reactions people have to some of our stories, you can never guess exactly how everyone's going to respond to a story. And who knows if some people aren't going to hold it against them for speaking up or say, oh, you should have done this or that differently. So their credit, you know, they were willing to step up and do that. But, I heard from people in Three Springs, I got an email that was angry about, hey, if this person's dangerous, you know, why would you wait a week to let us know who this is? And, you know, the fact of the matter, I think you'll see in part two, this isn't, you know, we can make all the assumptions we want, but I'm just going to lay out what he did. And there was never anything to suggest violence or anything like that, or a threat to the community. And he's lived there for many, many years. And so I said to this person, as nice as I could, you know, if you have to wait a few days to find out, he's been in the community for 7 years.
Right.
We all made the decision that it wasn't a present danger to the community, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's been difficult because I think I can say, you know, there's obviously been pushback from his people. They didn't want the story out there.
I want to ask you about that because again, in other stories where the sheriff had been involved, if there was a case pending or if there had been charges filed, anything like that, it's like, well, this is in the public record. This guy did it. He's been arrested. He's suspected of doing it. He's going to court, et cetera. In this case, you have a family presenting evidence to you against somebody else in their own community. You end up with a certain responsibility of, do I do this? Like, it's all on you, whatever fallout comes to the guy who did this.
Yeah.
Whether the community ostracizes him, whatever. Did you wrestle with that?
Of course, yeah. I mean, again, we do that in our jobs a lot. You know, there are ancillary victims of the people that commit crime sometimes, and the family suffers for something they had no idea was going on, had nothing to do with.
Yeah.
That happens all the time. Again, in this case, when presented all the evidence, I just said, this is a story. Whether or not the DA has decided to do anything with it yet, these are the kind of stories that get swept under the rug, and people that present an outward, you know, here's who my public face is. Right. And they're doing this stuff behind the scenes.
Okay, well, I'm going to ask you to kind of expand on that then, because like you say, this is a story. And like, it's a story, you could see this like being a novel or like a movie or a TV show. Like this is a story. But the newsworthiness of it is the thing that I'd like you to address. Because as you said, he's been in the community this many years. Nobody knew what he was doing. This family knew what he was doing, but he hasn't been violent. He hasn't like actually threatened anybody. So what benefit is there to publishing this in the newspaper?
Yeah, I mean, I think the point there is that people know that there's going to be accountability, even if you're a person in a position of power. You know, if I learned that someone that was doing this was, you know, Joe Schmo, you know, I didn't know him from Adam, I might have said it's just not worth it. But somebody that has been given this kind of responsibility and this kind of notoriety for his, you know, and I will say he's been a volunteer, he's been a philanthropist, he's given a lot back to this community. But I just felt that we should know this is the true reality and nature of this person. And again, maybe it will dissuade someone in the future from doing it. And the thing that I kept going back to was the family said to me, Kyle, you know, we're nervous based on his behavior that he could have done this to someone else. Whether it was a single girl that lived by herself and didn't have a whole family to support her and money and resources to have an attorney and do those sort of things. How can I, you know, I can't say I know that for sure, but I can look them in the eye. And when they say that sincerely, like, we don't want to be quiet about this. We feel there's other people, that there might be more victims. I had to make the decision that I can see where that's coming from. And we don't know that. And that is all just speculation. But when a family says to you, part of our dealing with what we've been through is we want to tell our story. I guess that's what I was enabling them to do. But hopefully people are hearing in my voice. It wasn't an easy decision. And I take no pleasure in any of the repercussions that might come to people in his family who had nothing to do with this. I mean, and that does make it difficult. So yeah, hopefully people are reading the story and I'm hearing a lot about, okay, what about part two? When are we going to see it? So you don't have to wait long. In fact, we're out a day early next week. I should tell people the Acorns are coming out on Wednesday instead of Thursday. So you'll see your paper a day early.
So there will be a little link in the actual print newspaper edition. There's a QR code. It's a new feature that will link back to this podcast. If you're talking to somebody about this story and they haven't heard the podcast, tell them to scan that thing and come check out the show because it'll give some good background.
Yeah, I mean, the questions you're asking are fair questions, and people are asking this of me and on social media, and I hope people will listen and now they'll get understand where I'm coming from.
This episode is brought to you by Oak and Iron Craft Cocktails at 2967 East Thousand Oaks Boulevard. Oak and Iron is open 5 days a week with happy hours all day Wednesday, Thursday, and Sunday, and then from 5 to 7 p.m. on Friday and Saturday. They have outdoor patio seating available in the front and back of the business and socially distanced service because they are very concerned about COVID, and good for them. Kyle, you have been there.
I have been there. Everyone knows I'm a huge fan of Oak and Iron, and with what we're doing right now with the new restrictions and the curfews and everything like that, they have these amazing cocktails to go. You can go right on. There's a little mobile website. Order it, pick it up, take it home, be with your family, but enjoy a great craft cocktail around Thanksgiving.
Check the show notes for links to their website. Tell them that Branching Out sent you.
That brings us to another story that we've talked about on the podcast before, and I wanted to give you a chance to kind of react and not only update the public, but also address some of these. Well, let me just get right to it. It's obviously the Rebecca Grossman story and the two boys that were hit in the crosswalk in Westlake Village, the Iskanders. There's a lot of frustration right now. It feels like from the community about the pace of this investigation, the fact that she hasn't even had a court date yet. Is that what you're experiencing?
Yeah, there are people who have taken to emailing me every time the paper, every Thursday or Friday, saying like, where's the Grossman story? I'm seeing stuff on Nextdoor is a cesspool anyway, but there's stuff happening there. Somebody started a petition to get the DA to take her to court. Like it's in the community. You can't talk about it with people without them saying like, why is she still out?
What are you trying to explain to these people? What is your response to them when they're asking you, why isn't there any information on this?
Well, my first response is I am just as much in the dark as you are. I am contacting the district attorney's office on a weekly basis to ask when is she going to court. And all they'll tell me is that they're still investigating. So I don't know. But the other thing is I'm trying to remind people like, okay, we just had an election. Jackie Lacey is out as the Los Angeles County District Attorney. They're bringing somebody new in. Maybe that's gumming up the works at the DA's office. We're also in a pandemic. The courts have been backed up since before March, and it's only slower now. And the third thing, and this is the one that I'm really trying to hammer home to people, is that somebody in Rebecca Grossman's position has recognition. She has friends in high places, I'm sure. She has money. Nobody seems to be making the connection that all of that can go towards buying an amazing defense team.
And I think another thing we have to remind people is that they're saying I'm hearing people saying she's getting off, you know, she's getting off scot-free. She's still out on bail, right?
Yes.
As far as you know. And even if she had been arraigned, it's not like she'd be in jail yet. I mean, even if she was arraigned at the date we originally thought in October, she would still be out on bail. Nothing would be different. So I do see that, and that's sometimes where I'm weighing and telling people, there's nothing yet to suggest she's received any favoritism. She had to pay a big old bail to get out.
Mm-hmm.
She is going to have to be in court. Problem is that we don't really know exactly why the delay, because you know all they told us is they need to investigate more. I mean, you even have people in the community saying that the Grossmans have paid us off, or they're hushing us. Have you received hush money? I mean, address that a little bit, because I can see it really seems to frustrate you.
So people are seeing this person who has money and who has connections to high society and stuff, and their immediate logical, quote-unquote, assumption is that all of that is going towards buying silence and buying the system off, as opposed to what I said previously, that they can afford an amazing defense attorney, which is where that money would be better spent anyway, because I can guarantee you if somebody from the Grossman organization walked into this office or contacted me saying like, hey, if you don't publish anything, we'll give you money. That's the headline story the next day.
Yeah. Let's be honest, you've not heard one iota from anyone on the Grossman side.
No, I haven't heard one word from anybody in that camp. I've been trying to get in touch. I would love to hear from their attorney.
Yeah.
But the cold hard fact of it is nobody's talking because this is a huge case. Yeah. It's going to drag on for years.
And I think this is the line we walk, Ian, is that we don't want to come off like we're making any excuses.
No, not at all.
We don't know. But and you've written about these boys. I mean, now you can't write a story like you did about them and not have emotions and feelings for what those family, the parents are going through.
I do want to say, like, I'm speaking right now as a representative of the ACORN.
Mm-hmm.
My job is not to editorialize. That's not what this podcast is for. That's not what the newspaper is for.
Yeah, and that's where the real challenge, and that's what separates your average Joe from your journalist, really.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not some magic card we get. It's the ability to say, we are going to hold off till we really know, because none of us were there that night.
Yeah.
And, you know, the person I'd love to speak with someone who was either a witness or a soon after witness. Unfortunately, those people, since we weren't there the night it happened, we don't know where they are.
Well, and the other thing too is verifying those accounts. I did speak to somebody who was passed by the scene shortly after, and she proved it with photos from a workout tracking app. But I saw a comment on Nextdoor from somebody saying they were at the memorial a few days after the accident, and they met Nancy Iskander there. And all these people are commenting, oh my God, I'm so glad you were there, et cetera. It's like, we have no way of knowing if this is true or if this just is somebody trying to get some kind of attention by jumping in on some kind of tragedy. The other thing is people keep emailing me like, where's the update? Like, this is the most read story on the Acorn. Where's the update? There's nothing to update. There's no journalistic service. We would be reprinting the same story week after week after week.
And I want people to understand it. And I appreciate you say that, is that once we get anything, we're going to run with it.
The smallest crumb of information, I will go with it. But there's nothing breaking right now. And the only story that I could write is the community is mad that there's nothing going on. And that's, I mean, the only update is there in the headline. Mm-hmm. So
I'm not necessarily opposed to that. But let's really quickly, for people that haven't been brought up to date on this, the most recent thing that your reporting was able to show was that there was somehow a second driver involved in this.
Yes.
And is involved the right word to say? I mean, as you understand it.
Yes. Involved insofar as it created the context under which Rebecca Grossman allegedly hit the kids. The way that I understand it is she and this second driver were racing, and not like a drag race, ready, set, go, but more that situation where you're on the road and you're trying to pass somebody or somebody's trying to pass you, and one or the other is not letting that happen. So you both just end up speeding up. And that is what led to the collision.
But beyond that, we don't have anything we can verify yet in terms of who that driver was, right? The circumstances that led up to them getting in this whatever race, right? And what the nature of that race was. I mean, that's what I keep hearing from people. I did appreciate you explaining that we're not talking about a drag race.
Yeah.
And I do feel comfortable when I'm hearing that they were not strangers. They knew each other. That I feel confident in saying.
Okay.
Now, I don't know what exactly that relationship was, but that I've heard enough to say that. And maybe you don't want to say that. But beyond that, we don't know. And I think a lot of people are seeing that second driver as almost like we're trying to give her an excuse. But really,
this is the only crumb of information we can provide. And we know you want to know everything. So do we. So we're giving you anything we can.
And so that driver, as far as you know, not been charged, ticketed, nothing.
It was questioned as part of the investigation. The other difficulty in reporting on this, and I think the other thing that's kind of stirring the community up, is this is a small community. And yeah, this was a big thing that stretched into the neighboring cities. But even so, like, there are people who move in certain social circles who know Rebecca Grossman, or who know people who know her, or who know people who know people who know her. And there are rumors abounding. I've heard all kinds of stories. I'm not comfortable saying anything, regardless of how many times I hear the rumor, because to me it's just a rumor. Until I hear it from the horse's mouth, or somebody confirms it, or I see proof for myself, me as a journalist, I'm not comfortable putting it out there, because that can come back and bite me in the ass.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's one of the toughest things we have to do. And you're right. The repetition is what really gets you.
Because
you do hear it enough times.
Yeah. And you hear it from enough different sources, too.
Yeah. But until we have, there's just too much on the line. And it goes back to with my story. I wasn't comfortable running it until I had everything that I knew I was going to be able to get to a degree. Same with you. And again, I want to use this as an opportunity. I don't know with our listenership, if there's going to be someone out there. But yeah, someone that is willing to go on the record and share some of these details with you, call Ian, text Ian, email Ian. I don't like this idea that you don't want to, or that we are reticent of running another story. And it frustrates us just as much as it's frustrating people in the community that we are closer to knowing more. But again, our job dictates that we can't go with something until we're 100%. Not in something that's this emotional. I mean, that's where you understand where they're coming from in some ways. I know you're frustrated, but I also know why this is such an awful thing that happened, right? And I think we can't be that shocked that the community wants answers, right?
I'm not shocked that the community wants answers. I grew up here. I'm part of this community. I want answers. But my job is to report facts. I cannot take a position on this in our publication.
And I think what people forget about, right, and you made this good point, is that if our reporting is irresponsible – to a degree that an attorney can take it to court and say this either biased the jury or biased this as poison the well, and suddenly she gets to have a trial in San Luis Obispo. Yeah. I mean, we don't want to affect the outcome.
No, that's the other thing that's hanging over my head with every story, every update I do on this. Every word I write about this is my name going to get brought up in this courtroom? I don't want anything like that to happen, because I won't be able to sleep at night.
And if anything I'm staying on you every week about it. If I can reassure everyone that I'm asking some of these same questions too. I know you're getting frustrated at me. So again, we understand where you're coming from. We want those answers, and I have every confidence that, yeah, as soon as you get them, we're going to run with them. So
people who are outraged on social media, people who are outraged on behalf of the family, I get it. Yes, the family deserves justice. But take note of the fact that the family hasn't said anything. I've tried to reach out to them. We're the local paper. I'm in touch with people who are in touch with them. If they want to talk, I'm here to listen.
Yeah.
But until they start criticizing the DA for moving too slowly, I'm gonna keep my mouth shut about how that's going.
They inherently care, have the most at stake in this. Yeah. And you're right. They're being down on doors saying the same thing. That would be on the front page.
Yes.
And we don't know why they haven't yet, but they haven't. And that does make me start think that whatever they're hearing, and that's why I'm reassuring people, although I don't know, but I feel very strongly she will be charged. It may not be in the timeline that people want it to be, but she will be charged. And so if that's what you're, you know, angry about, you know, there's much bigger things to be worried about right now. I think her day in court is coming. So thanks for taking the time to do that. We will get out of here. We want to get that short week started. A reminder to everybody, I mentioned it once, your Acorn will be coming out a day early this week. It only happens once a year. Exciting time. A
couple times, depending on the...
Well, you're right. If Christmas or another holiday falls, it can. But sometimes it only happens once a year, and it definitely always happens on Thanksgiving. So don't miss your paper. If you're going to leave town, take your Acorn with you. It'll be there Wednesday. Or don't leave town and just have Thanksgiving among your immediate family and play it safe. So this has been Kyle Jory, editor of Thousand Oaks Acorn. Follow me on Twitter. Tell me what you think about the story I published. I'd love to hear the response. I'm at Kyle B. Jory.
This is Ian Bradley. You can find me on Twitter at Ian_reports. If you'd like to comment on this episode, if you'd like to share your thoughts on the Grossman case, happy to hear from you. Conspiracy theories can kick rocks. I'm not interested in that. Follow the podcast on Twitter at BranchingOutPod. Email us at branchingout@theacorn.com. Hit follow, hit subscribe, tell your friends.
Support our sponsor.
Yes, support our sponsor. Otherwise, we will see you all next week. Have a happy holiday. Wear your mask over your nose.